This is Dark City Radio, where we do it professionally, just for us.
So I'll wait at the Skipuli at the Skipuli. This is Miles Crisp with Divergent History. It'll be a casual show about the study of the past. Think of it like being at a bar with a few professors. This is the sort of stuff they would talk about. So let's have a beer and get started. First thing I wanted to get onto was Atlantis and aliens. A lot of people have heard of the story of Atlantis, and I'm not going to tell you I know where it is. I'm not going to tell you... Well, I am going to tell you what I think about it, but... all right. You have a sunken continent. That's the story. It comes from Plato. Plato heard it from a guy in Greece. I mean, excuse me, a guy that went to Egypt. I don't remember his name. It starts with a P. I'll get back to you on that next week. I've had a hell of a week this week. I've ended up moving a bunch of old records with a friend of mine that was 200 miles away and 30 hours being awake 2 days this week for the past 4 days. Like, I've had, like, 2 days in the past three. If that makes any sense. Anyhow, you have a sunken continent. That's the essence of the story. Mu, Lemuria, same thing. It's still talking about a sunken continent. You have Sundaland, which is spelled S-U-N-D-A-L-A-N-D. That's essentially Indonesia being connected to the south of Asia right there, where you have Thailand and Burma. That was all one land mass, and they refer to it as Sunda. Or Sundaland. That is very shallow, so when the sea levels were lower, basically before 8,000 years ago, the sea levels, the 8,000 to 9,000 years ago is when they started rising, more or less. I could get into a whole show just discussing the various dates. You can go look this up on Wikipedia. I'm in the ballpark, and you can... I could give you a date anywhere from 7,000 to 12,000. Anyway, I don't want to get into that. So the sea levels rose very quickly, and if you had a people and a culture with telling stories and folk tales and developing a mythology, the mythology records that there was a massive flood. And that's why you have Atlantis stories all around the world. You have it in the Pacific Islands, you have it in Africa, you have it in India, you have it in Europe, you have it in the Middle East, you even have it here in America in the New World. There was Paleo-Indians that lived in the Delmarva Peninsula. That's basically, if you can imagine, the Chesapeake Bay just east of Washington, D.C., Delaware, eastern Maryland, and that little peninsular part of Virginia on the other side of the bay is the Delmarva Peninsula. Delaware, Maryland, Virginia, Delmarva, that's where you get the word. Paleo-Indians ended up dying out there when the Younger Dryas event occurred. And that was a period more or less about 12,100, basically about 12,000 years ago. You had the Younger Dryas, and the previous 15,000 years up to that point, let me back up. The maximum glacial extent of the last ice age was about 25,000 years ago. So the coldest it ever got in the past 200,000 years, when you have humans running around on the face of the Earth, about 25,000 years ago, that was the maximum. Between about 15,000 and 12,000 years ago, it got warmer. It actually, this is hard to understand, but it's at times it got warmer than it is today, even with the present global warming. That's a topic for another show, because I think that's very misinterpreted, although I do think climate change is occurring, because climate's always changing. So it got much warmer for about 10,000 years from, 15,000 years ago until about 12,000 years ago. The Paleo-Indians were living in the Americas from about 14 to 13,000 years ago. So they were living during this warm period before the end of the last ice age. The Younger Dryas event basically killed them off, wiped them out, because it just got too damn cold. Eventually it started warming after that, and I would love to be able to post what I'm looking at. If you look at my Facebook page, which is on the Dark City Radio website, you could see the link to my Facebook. I can put up the images, because these graphs are a little too complicated to just start explaining. I'm just going to start racking out dates, and it's going to sound like nonsense. But the point is, sea levels started rising after the Younger Dryas, and you started getting the true warm period that we've been enjoying ever since as humans at the end of the last, since the end of the last ice age, about 8,000 years ago. Now, that flooded everything pretty quickly, and the cultures recorded that, so I think Atlantis is essentially just the Greek version of the human memory of seas rising. And people even today, most I don't know what the statistic is, but I know at least in the United States, something like 50-something-odd% of the population lives within 100 miles of either the east or west coast. There's a lot of people tend to live on the coast because it's easier to, not only can you fish, but the weather's a little more stable. It usually, even if you're up north in Maine, if you're up against the sea, or the English, England, Britain, all that, I mean, you guys would be freezing your asses off, because if you just draw a line over on the globe, you're up in northern Canada there, it's freezing. You're only being kept warm by the Gulf Stream. Want to know about the Gulf Stream? It's part of the thermohaline cycle. You can look this up. It's basically hot water rises at the equator, goes north and south respectively to the polar regions where it cools down. Cold water is heavier than warm water, sinks to the bottom of the ocean. That's where you have the cold currents flowing down that drives this whole cycle. One of the doomsday theories with global warming is that if the ice sheets on Greenland melt, that would desalinate a lot of the water. Now, by desalinate, I mean it would make it less salty. It would still be fucking salt water and everything. But if that happened, it would change the density of the cold water. And salt water is denser than fresh water. So if you make it fresher, you're making it less dense. If it's not dense enough to fall down and drive the cycle could shut down. And the cycle did shut down. And that's one of the reasons why these dates are so confusing with what I was talking about. Because the Younger Dryas event, I don't think it was a shutdown of the thermohaline cycle, but it definitely became denuded, or something came in to affect that. Now, Dr. Robert Schock, the geologist at Boston University, who in 1993 went with John Anthony West to Egypt investigating the water erosion on the Sphinx, he came up with an idea in his recent book that I should have in front of me, but I don't. Anyway, it just came out this year. It's very interesting. He's speculating that because of the, you know, what ended the last ice age? Why did it happen? Was it volcanic activity? Was it the sun heating up? What was it? The greenhouse effects that you hear about? He's speculating that it had to do with the sun, because all the other cycles come as a result of that. If the sun heats up dramatically, the planet heats up dramatically. If it cools dramatically, the planet cools dramatically. The greenhouse stuff, the CO2, the methane, by the way, methane's a 20 to 40 times greater greenhouse agent, pound for pound, than hard carbon dioxide, and the majority of carbon dioxide that's released into the atmosphere comes out of the...
We are experiencing some technical difficulties. I will try to get Miles Crisp back.
Okay, well, I have no idea at what point it crapped out, so I'm just going to start with something else. If you want to know about Atlantis, I can put together something more about it later. Essentially, I just think it's a global sea level rise tale, was told by many different perspectives, and Atlantis is just the Greek version of it. All right, aliens as a religion. Who built the pyramids? Who made Stonehenge? Who built Göbekli Tepe? Who made all of these ancient sites that are very complicated? Stones 200,000 tons fitted together with laser-like precision, supposedly, you know, 2, 3, 4,000 BC. How the hell did that happen?
Well, you know, there are many theories that say that they are built by alien space machinery.
Exactly. Just like there were many theories 100 and 200 years ago that said God did it. because you don't, people don't understand. They have, it's just too far removed from anything we have familiarity with. They latch on to something that they are familiar with. Space aliens, I think, is basically like the modern version of looking to the Bible for these explanations, because it's a cop-out. Mm-hmm. Oh, aliens did it. Well, they must have had great technology. In fact, their technology was so good, they crashed into each other at Roswell. So the story goes. Yeah, you flew all this way, and then you, what, you had too many beers or something, and then you crashed after traversing the universe? Yeah, you're a superior species to us? Okay.
Yes.
You know?
Well, yeah, the people usually, when they stumble upon the unknown, they try to seek for answers in the supernatural realm until a better explanation is being found. Just like in the astronomy realm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know how Newton discovered some cosmic laws, and then for the rest of it, he just said God made it until someone else appeared and said that, stars work like this and there are galaxies and stuff, you know?
Yeah, but who made God? I mean, that's not the whole story. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, the Big Bang's just from what we can look back. Yeah. Upon. It doesn't, we can't, Stephen Hawking's Brief History of Time book, he talks about how asking the question, what happened before the beginning of the space, you know, from the space-time singularity of the Big Bang, when space and time were one, sounds biblical, doesn't it? But any question before time existed is impossible to ask, because time is change. If there's nothing changing, no time really elapsed. You know what I mean? So there isn't anything that could have happened before time began. And that was one of the side notes that he had in A Brief History of Time. Now I think there's much different interpretations of it. And I'm not very versed in physics, but
I was just making a parallel on how people just when they stumble upon the unknown, they just start to say, oh, it's God or some kind of supernatural force, and now since God is so overrated and unpopular, you know, they mm-hmm. started to look towards the aliens. So let's go back to the ancient buildings and tell us your theory.
Well, this is going to sound really bad, but I have absolutely no clue how they were built. I insist and will go to my grave insisting that they were more likely built by human beings that had a technology or a skill we've lost, because that's been documented to have happened. I mean, reading alone came in and around the Mediterranean region three or four times, depending on the location. You have the Greek Dark Ages from 1100 BC until about 600 BC, where for 500 years, writing was forgotten. You have the Linear A and then Linear B script, and what ended up turning and becoming ancient Greek. They pretty much had to start from scratch. I don't know if anybody's heard of the Sea Peoples of about 1100 BC. Nancy K. Sanders and Drew Daniels wrote books about this in the 70s and 80s, respectively, about various theories explaining the Sea Peoples. Now, this is you have about 70% of cities in the Eastern Mediterranean from 1100 to 1200 BC being destroyed, sometimes by fire, sometimes by abandonment, sometimes it is obviously a warfare kind of siege. They, you know, broke down the walls and burned it down, kind of thing. There's sites right, you know, 20 miles next to others that are fine. It's weird. The story from the Egyptians is that there were these people with horns on their helmets, actually. That I don't know if that's where the Viking myth came from later on, but they're depicted in Abydos as actually, Karnak, these sea peoples coming in. The Egyptians managed to defend them off, but a lot of their neighbors, this is what brought down the Hittites, their empire in Turkey, Hittosis, that brought them down. It destroyed the Minoans, and the Phoenicians more or less weathered it because they were able to flee and go to, they were very versed at seafaring. It's also not controversial that the Minoans, I mean, that the Phoenicians were trading with the coast of Wales, Ireland, and southern England for tin around about 1000 BC. That's pretty documented. Oh, getting into linguistics on that note, oblaut, sing, sang, sung, as opposed to walk, walked. The irregular verbs in English, that's called oblaut when you change the central vowel sound. That's a habit of Semitic languages, of which the Phoenician language was a part. German shows a curious correlation. This is really off-the-wall, you know, linguistic theory here, but it's not, you know, this isn't talked about openly very much, but German words, apparently about one third of them, share a curious relationship with the language of Ethiopia of it's escaping me right now, but it's another Semitic language. And if that's the case, it seems like there was some sort of contact, probably with the Phoenicians, up in up around the North Sea and getting into the Baltic Sea region, and it was enough to cause a linguistic, it was enough to leave a linguistic mark, is what I'm saying. Linguistics, archaeology, history, and the study of cultural anthropology and physical anthropology are basically the only tools we have to try to figure out what happened anytime.
Hey, Miles, before you move into something else, do we have a question from the chat room?
Okay.
And John says, ask the guest if he thinks it was possible that at some point the gravity field of the Earth was much higher, and this made moving heavy stones easier. A bit like moving rocks through water, but not as easier as that.
I don't think the gravity of Earth has ever changed, because gravity is a result of mass, and if the gravity was higher, the Earth would have had to have been bigger in the past. Or if you wanted to make the gravity lighter, the Earth would have had to have been smaller in the past. I don't know if anybody remembers Edgar Rice Burroughs' The Princess of Mars story, but the guy goes to Mars and he can, you know, jump 100 feet into the air because it's a quarter of the gravity, but his muscles are designed for Earth. Could there have been a technology that in a certain little force field or a little chamber in that area locally changed the gravity, and that's how they could have moved the stones? Possibly. It's an intriguing theory. I know there have been a lot of research with sound waves trying to be used to somehow lighten them. But, I don't know. Honestly, John, I'm sorry, but that's about all I can say.
Okay, cool. You were going into the general knowledge that we have through anthropology, history, and what were you saying?
Well, basically, when you're getting into what I'm studying, which is basically people before there was writing, after you have writing, it's less interesting to me, because then it's history. All you're doing is studying that stuff. I'm trying to figure out before any of the stuff has been figured out. That's the frontier of the research of the field of studying humanity. I'm much more interested in things from 10,000 years ago. Göbekli Tepe in Turkey is dated to about 12,000 BC. 10,000 BC, 12,000 years ago, I think. I could be 200 years off on that, because it keeps getting confusing switching between years ago and BC. But there's not supposed to have been agriculture at that point. The people that made that thing were apparently nomadic hunter-gatherers. You probably remember from a history class at some point talking about all man was hunter, you know, hunting and gathering, and they did this wandering around for thousands of years until somebody decided to start growing a plant. And then they domesticated that plant. And then they started, you know, living in settled villages. And also you have animal husbandry that begins. But animal husbandry predates settlement. The dog was domesticated before anybody was settled down. The dog came into North America through the land bridge trade. And I also think there was a sea route that was the first route into the New World. But I can get into that later if you'd like.
I think sometimes official information, official studies, just add things to their projects so that the whole theory makes sense. But they just add it. It doesn't necessarily mean that it is the way they tell you it is. They just make it like that so their theory works so they can sell it.
Well, I don't know if there's a lot of selling going on because, especially with the stuff that I'm referring to here, nobody really cares. There's not any kind of withholding of the information. There's no conspiracy. Most people just simply don't give a damn. But you have to have a paradigm. You can't have a scientific approach without, you know, knowing what, you know, all right, here's everything we know for sure, 100%. Here's everything we know about 90%. And then everything else has to be excluded until you can raise that standard of empirical evidence to accept it into the paradigm. So the science is basically about 100 years or 200 years behind the cutting edge of the research because they have to remain conservative. If they go all over the place, that's when you get things like eugenics in the 10s and 20s and 30s. People thinking, oh, well, we figured out human evolution. Black people must be inherently inferior, blah, 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 blah. You get things like that when you start, you know, just, oh, okay, here's some crazy theory that's 10% provable. Let's incorporate it as 100% fact. You know? Better to be safe than sorry. But I understand the annoyance of paradigms because, like, the water erosion on the Sphinx with Robert Schock and John Anthony West, in geology, that's proven, that's science. All the geologists acknowledge it, no problem, not controversial. Egyptology? Nope. They think it's a hoax. They somehow think water erosion is a hoax, or as the joke is with John Anthony West, is the thing you have to understand is there was a storm cloud over the Sphinx for 4,000 years after it was built, and it only rained there. Because it has water erosion on it. It has water erosion that the Egyptians repaired. They actually built blocks to repair the sides of the Sphinx, and the blocks fit into the water-eroded sides. They didn't build the Sphinx. They repaired it. Why is the head so proportionately smaller to the body than everything else? Everything else is in perfect proportion to a lion's body, except the head is small. Small because it's probably been recarved 10 times. You know?
Yeah, it makes sense. It makes sense.
And the temple, the Sphinx and Valley Temple, built from the rock that's hewn around it to create the actual the body and the rump of the Sphinx to carve that out. They took those blocks and built two temples that sit in front of the Sphinx. It's called the Sphinx and Valley Temple. Those have water erosion on them too. And those also have repair work done to them as well. You know, and then you get to the Egyptological hypothesis that the Great Pyramid was built in 20 years. I mean, even if they could change the gravity, I don't think they could get that done in 20 years. But that's just
so
me.
20 years is the official statement.
The last time I bothered reading about it, yep. They may have changed it now to a little bit longer or something. I'm not sure. In response to some of the newer work that's been coming up over the years. But
one might say that 20 years is a lot of time. So how many years do you think it took?
How many people have seen a highway construction project near where they live?
Well, in my country, they last like 3 years to make, 400 kilometers. I don't know if you're familiar with that system, but
yeah, they're talking roughly 200 something.
And most of the time, they are interrupted, and the funding is getting cut down, and they take some time. You know, probably in Egypt they also had the wars, so I imagine a lot of budget cuts for projects like this.
Well, for a while there, historically the Egyptians were getting a lot of gold from the south there in Numidia, but what's now Sudan. But I mean, I don't think they. The sheer scale is mind-boggling, and the pyramid itself. I don't know if a lot of listeners know this, but the bottom part of the pyramid is actually natural bedrock. The base of the pyramid's not flat. However, the base of all four corners are perfectly in level alignment to one another. But they didn't just make it all flat and then start building it. They actually built it on top of a higgledy-piggledy kind of rock outcropping, and yet maintained perfect level precision with the building work, if that makes any sense what I'm explaining. Mm-hmm. So the subterranean chamber that is basically cut out of living bedrock in the bottom fifth or sixth of the pyramid towards the core, that could have been cut out of a rock outcropping before there was ever a building there. That part of the pyramid could go back 100,000 years, for all we know. Sacred sites have been known to have been repeated and continued to be used for, you know, through cultures. The Spanish temples in Mexico were built on top of the Spanish churches, Catholic churches, were built on the temples of the previously existing religions. Those temples were built on sacred sites that go back before those people were even building temples. Some of them are at springs, some of them are little natural caves or sacred spots.
Only in my country you see a lot of monasteries near these caves and springs, but I think, like, and in some cases here, there were actually monks first that lived in the cave without any monastery, and then when they found funds to build the monastery, they built the monastery next to the cave as a symbol for how much time they stood in the cave. So the reason, I think, is variable to the place.
Exactly. And when it comes to dating the pyramid, I think the pyramid was almost certainly built in phases. And when those phases began and ended, the Egyptians probably had – I mean, it'd be very difficult to believe you have a civilization and you've got this giant pyramid over there and it doesn't become part of your culture. It's very hard for me to fathom that. So the Egyptians – almost certainly had a hand in repairing it or finishing it up, or completed the structure with the limestone casing blocks they built around it, so that it actually shone in the sun, in the light of the sun. They could have done that, but the entire thing from scratch, just up and building it, and then you look at the bent pyramid. For example, that was built apparently only 200 years previous. They couldn't even get the angle of the rocks of the construction right so that it wouldn't collapse on itself. And yet, less than 300 years later, they ended up building this masterpiece that hasn't been replicated essentially before or since. And even modern, the biggest cranes we have that I'm aware of, it takes two of these biggest cranes to be able to lift 200 tons. Well, there's a lot of 200-ton blocks 300 feet up in the air put in with precision. And these people, according to the Egyptologists, didn't even have block-and-tackle pulleys. They had pulleys to change the direction of a rope, but they didn't actually use it for mechanical advantage. That's pretty fucking stupid. I mean, if you have a pulley and you're constructing things, you're going to figure out the block-and-tackle system. It's not that complicated. You're going to figure that out. But beyond that, where'd they get the wood? Where'd they get the rope? You ever been to Egypt since 6,000 years ago? It's pretty dry. There's not a lot of trees. There's cedars of Lebanon that have been found in some of the temples and burial things that the old kingdom Egyptians were building. And their ships for the Nile River and things like that were all built from imported wood. Mm-hmm. Or they were made out of reeds.
So how much is the official dating to these pyramids?
The official dating is that it comes from the pharaoh Chefren around 2500 BC.
So when it was pretty dry.
Yeah, pretty much. Mm-hmm.
So you are saying that these people actually inherited these pyramids from a previous civilization pre-flood days.
Oh, yeah. And there's a site from 7,000 BC, I think, that's called Nabta Playa. It's N-A-B-T-A space P-L-A-Y-A. That's a site that's aligned to the equinoxes and solstices and star constellations and things like that. It's out in the Nile. It's out in the Egyptian desert, and back then it wasn't a desert. The Bantu people of the Sahara regions, further south in Africa, have legends and stories of living much further north. Many, 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 many years ago, when the savanna was up in that area, and they just simply followed the game, and you know, the process of desertification. You hear about this, but the Sahara is spreading even to this day. It's affecting countries like Mali and Nigeria a lot. I guess it's basically been spreading since about 6,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. And the water erosion that's actually on the Sphinx is, you know, sometimes 3 or 4 feet deep, 2 or 3 feet wide in solid limestone bedrock. For that to have happened from rain, we're talking thousands of years of rain.
Yes.
The Sphinx is probably, and then you have the work with Robert Bouval. Graham Hancock cites him a lot. Graham Hancock, you guys might be familiar with. He wrote Fingerprints of the Gods. He did The Sign in the Sea. Oh, no, that was the other thing. But anyway, he did Fingerprints of the Gods. He's kind of like a journalist for ancient history. He doesn't really posit so many theories as he just sort of gives people information, and he cites himself obsessive compulsively. He's the most more footnotes and endnotes in his books than anybody else's. Robert Bouval talked with him at length, and his theory is that the three great pyramids on the Giza Plateau, in conjunction with the Nile River, line up to the constellation Orion. The three stars on Orion's belt are the pyramids, and the Milky Way is the Nile River. In order for that to be in alignment, it has to be about 10,500 BC. That, he thinks, would be the date that stuff was constructed. But the cycles repeat every 24,000 years, so it could be 24,000 years before that, 24,000 years before that. The precession of the equinox with the wobbling of the Earth's axis, that's a 24,000 year cycle. So you're going to end up coming back to the same thing. It's mm-hmm. It's not a concrete date, but that is a very popular theory. And again, it's from a man called Robert Bouval. I can't remember the name of his book. I think it's called The Orion Mystery or something like that. That would be something if anybody's interested to check out. Another thing I wanted to discuss tonight was the Salutrian rock. It's a type of hand axe that was made in the west coast of Europe, Western Europe, about 30,000 years ago. There's very controversial theory that there's a stone from those Paleo-Indians I was trying to talk about before I got garbled. I don't know if that even came out. Living on the Delmarva Peninsula, they used something called a Clovis point. And some people think that that bears a stunning resemblance to the Salutrian. I disagree. But if that is true, you would have evidence of contact from Europe into the Americas about 30,000 years ago. Getting further back in time, though, Australia in the south near Tasmania was settled by human beings 55,000 years ago. They had to use a boat to get there. Australia was at no point in sea level height connected, at least not during humanity's time on the planet as far as we're concerned in the past 200,000 years. They had to sail there. If they sailed there, they were behaviorally modern. And people tell us that we weren't behaviorally modern yet at that time because they can't prove that we had abstract thought. Abstract thought in archaeology is proven with some sort of art. You have to paint something on a cave or make a little figurine. Apparently making a fish hook with a barb on it doesn't constitute abstract thinking. I disagree with that entirely, but that's the paradigm we're working with. You have trade of seashells in Africa 80,000 years ago. I have Scientific American in 2006 to cite for that. It's not controversial. You have Australia was basically peopled about 60,000 years ago. If that's the case, why is it controversial for the Phoenicians to have sailed to Wales 1,000 BC? Why is it controversial, or 5,000 BC for that matter? Why is it controversial for the New World to have been settled by people coming from more or less the east coast of Siberia 16,000 years ago? Why is that controversial? If the Australian Aborigines could do it four times longer ago, you know, that doesn't make any sense. There's a lot of Western bias and racism. A lot of this boils down to it. I hate to have to take that tact, but a lot of it boils down to, brown people couldn't possibly figure out how to do that because we didn't figure out how to do it until the 1500s. You know?
Yeah. There's a question from previous talk, like from 20 minutes ago, if you want to.
Please. I did not have a lot of time to plan for this tonight, so I apologize. I wanted to have more of a structure for y'all to actually like kind of have this more like a class, but I apologize. Yeah, please go ahead.
There's someone saying there's Vindolanda. I don't know how to pronounce this name. Could Earth have been a barren planet and humanity and animal life turned up as a result of a meteor strike? The meteor carrying life from another planet, hence
panspermia. Yes, panspermia, the theory by which planets can be seeded with life from extraterrestrial objects such as meteor impacts. Yes, that is a very, very, very interesting theory. Answer the question? Absolutely. There's life forms that NASA's put out in space that apparently they're microscopic animals, but they can apparently survive minus 300 Fahrenheit plus 300 Fahrenheit. They could withstand 1,000 times the radiation that would require to kill an elephant. They actually can die for hundreds of years, shrivel up, and then have water put on them and come right back. So
is a plausible theory then.
Now, did it start on Earth and go elsewhere, or did it start elsewhere and come to Earth? Don't know.
Yeah, there's no way for us to actually verify that.
Unless you actually go to another planet and find life on it and then realize, oh shit, Well, actually, no, because then that wouldn't tell you before or after. So, yeah, that's, yeah. Absolutely. It's called panspermia.
Yeah, I'll type it in the chat room.
Okay.
It's good to have on organized shows because it makes for really interesting discussions, you know. Like, when you plan something, it might not end up as good as the freestyle.
Right. Well, I remember listening to some of the previous program talking about how, Westerners just wipe and smear the crap all around instead of actually washing themselves like the Indians. I was in India for a month, and I totally agree with that. I've adopted their method after coming home. It is cleaner.
Cleaner where?
You're using like a cup of water to sort of like rinse yourself after you take a shit instead of wiping it with toilet paper.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
If you're not Indian or haven't been there, you probably have no idea what I'm talking about.
Well,
it sounds a lot dirtier than it really is. I mean, anyway. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know. I kind of imagine what it would be like. In my civilization, they used to have wooden toilets with a hole inside, outside in the yard, and collected all that stuff and use it for fertilizing soil.
Yeah, in Arlington, just across the Potomac River from Washington, D.C. in Virginia, Arlington had a wastewater facility that had an effluent spillway. And it was like 100 yards wide and maybe 500 yards long. And they would release the effluent, which is a fancy word for shit-laden water, and let it evaporate out in the sun. And then they'd come in with a tractor and a front-end loader and scrape it up into a pile. And people from, residents around there would come for free as they wanted to and gather some of it and put it on their gardens.
For free?
Yeah.
That's a really good strategy.
Well, I mean, you can't really charge somebody for using their own shit. I mean, come on.
they're doing
a service by getting rid of it for the city.
It's an interesting system, though. Never heard about such things. It's interesting. Here at Dark City Radio, we talk about all the interesting stuff, including systems through which towns gathered shit that people could use to fertilize their plants for free.
The only reason they stopped doing it is when the population started rising dramatically after the 1970s. It worked when the town was pretty small. And Washington, D.C. in the 70s had cow farms in Northwest. A lot of this suburban sprawl and development, at least in this part of the United States, didn't really get started until the 70s, late 70s. I mean, my mom told me in the 70s, in the 80s even, you used to be able to go down to the mall, sit in front of the Washington Monument in the grass and bring a little grill and have a cooler of beer and sit there and light up a joint and nobody bothered you. Definitely not like that now.
How is it now?
A lot of the streets are closed. A lot of the streets close randomly. You're not allowed to have... I think you're still allowed to smoke a cigarette on the mall, but you're not allowed to camp. You're not allowed to have like a grill or anything. You can't have alcohol anymore. Like with the 4th of July, they used to let you bring beer. Now you can't, so everybody has a flask. And, it's pretty much just, bona fide police state.
Very, very restrictive. I guess it's gotten like this in the last 20 years.
Last 15 or
10?
12 since 9/11, basically.
That's when it
started getting really bad. Before then, it wasn't terrible. The terror was really just the parking before that.
So the restrictions like these are not really justified for 9/11. I mean, in my opinion, you know.
It's an excuse to crack down. I mean, why do you think you see so many false flag theories and, 9/11 truth movements and stuff like that going on? Because, you know, it's like, the Lusitania was sunk by the Germans. The advertisement in the newspaper next to the Lusitania ad was an ad from the German Kaiser that warned Americans and British not to get on that ship because they knew it had munitions on it and they were going to sink it. You know,
yes.
after that, at least on the American side, that got us involved in the Great War, such that we were involved in it. And I think it was less than 100 days boots on the ground from the American Expeditionary Force. But I don't know, that's a different story. You have the USS Maine that got us involved in the Spanish-American War. That turned out to be a boiler explosion, but they said it was the Spanish attacking us. You've got the Tonkin Gulf incident. McNamara admitted this.
Yes.
He's admitted it. We staged it.
Yes. Well, there are also a lot of declassified documents coming in recently from 1980s, 1970s.
Those are released. They release those when they want to.
When it's too late to make any difference.
Well, yeah. I agree with you there. Yeah. When
people are too ignorant to even bother to read them, so it just becomes like, I don't care.
Yeah.
You know? Stuff like that.
It's like living at the, I imagine this must have been what it felt like around the city of Rome around 400 AD when everything was collapsing. You know, everybody knew it was collapsing, but what did they do? Nothing. Because you had a vested interest in the collapse. That's the horrible irony here. We have a vested, you don't like banks, do you, Vosto?
Not at all. I believe that big banks are the main negative propulsion engine of our current shitty economical systems.
I'm inclined to agree, but I have a question for you, my friend. Do you use a bank account?
Not now. No. No?
No? At all?
Well, no. I don't use it. I probably have one just in case I want to do some online acquisitions.
Well, that's what I meant. Like, not necessarily. Do you have a bank account? That's what I really meant.
Yes. It's optional. I'm not dependent.
You're participating with the beast that you're deploring.
Yes. However,
because you have to. You have you have a vested interest in your own collapse.
I just have some money. Yeah, I know what you mean. It's correct for most of the population who actually uses the bank account more than physical money. But for me, I just put some money in the bank when I want to buy stuff online. But that is very, very rarely. Like for food and basic necessities, I just use physical money. You know,
okay.
That I don't even get from the bank, you know.
That's the way to do it, because if you're just putting money in a bank and then taking it out in cash, it's the same difference, because then, actually, you know, in a lot of ways, that's worse. Because if you take out, at least in the United States, if you take out a lot of cash, they assume you're buying dope. I'm serious. I mean, that's what they assume. Like, if you were going to go to Walmart and buy a big TV or something and spend $800, you just use your debit card or your credit card, or maybe you'd write a check.
If not, you're on the blacklist of terrorism or something.
Well, just in 2003, when I got out of high school, I went to buy a computer for myself, and I was working at Burger King at the time, and it took me about 9 months, and I saved up, I think it was $1,800. I was going to get myself a decent desktop computer at the time. Mm-hmm. Went to pay cash for it at Best Buy, and they said I couldn't. I had to get the manager over and start yelling and screaming about legal tender in order for them to override their system and let me give them the money. Mm-hmm. And they didn't think it was counterfeit or anything. That meant that somebody at a management would have to write up a deposit slip, put it in an envelope, bring it to the bank, You know what I mean? As opposed to, oh, just swipe your card, please.
Yes, yes.
I think convenience. It's just laziness. And, you know, I mean, I can understand. You know, I had a friend, a manager at Burger King. He had to take a cash deposit to the bank every night at 2 o'clock in the morning. That's not fun. There's a reason he had a 38 revolver in his pocket.
The bank policy was shitty then because he had to wake up at that time. The system is made to frustrate you.
That's when we closed the store, and you know, at the end of each day, he had to bring the money the store made to the bank. Mm-hmm. As part of his job. And since it's late at night when stores usually close, that, like, going back to my buying the computer, the guy probably didn't want to have to go through that hassle.
Everything is becoming obsolete. Form itself, it's becoming obsolete and replaced by virtual. Mainly just pushing forward towards post-materialist, post-human era.
Planned obsolescence too. It's not. It's one thing if a steam engine becomes obsolete when somebody invents a car. It's another thing when somebody set a date for the invention of the car. Mm-hmm. You know. You have Moore's Law with one of the guys who used to work with IBM. I think it's something like processing ability increases exponentially as the cost of the computer parts go down. That's why you can get a computer right now that in 1970 the Pentagon only had, you know?
Do fossils in meteors prove that panspermia is actually happening? Because Rabbit Pinch says in the chat room that they found fossils in meteors, which confirms panspermia.
Yeah, and you could probably find just as many sources saying that they didn't find fossils in those same meteorites. But there's something called the Merkinson meteorite. I don't remember when it was found, but that has 3 times the amino acids that are found on Earth. And amino acids are what are used to create proteins that are used in biology for life processes.
Yeah.
There's only a third of what we have that was found on this meteorite. So there's a lot more variability for, at least for amino acids that we know. And that I could give you with 100% certainty. Now, the evidence of with the Martian meteorite fossils he might be referring to. There's another rock that came from that was found on the moon from the Apollo program that they thought for a little while had fossils on it. I don't know. That's not my area of expertise. I think it's fascinating. I'd love for it to be proven, but mm-hmm. at least as far as I've read, the jury's still out. But you could research and find evidence that would corroborate or do the opposite just as easily.
Yeah, the thing is debatable. There are always two sides to something, and each of the sides fight desperately to win. Like in
but
every
if they did,
other
if they
sport.
Did prove it, it would prove panspermia.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it would have to be a living. Microbe from
the amino acids thing that you said earlier. Do you think that is like a tipping point in biology, or opens a new window towards understanding new things?
But what are you talking about? Having like on the Merkinson meteorite, having all these extra amino acids?
Yeah,
absolutely. You could have totally different. DNA is only made out of 4 chemicals.
Mm-hmm.
What if you had a DNA that was made out of 40?
Oh.
Can you imagine what the life form would be like? You could have something that could manifest gamma ray radiation through an orifice on its body, for all we know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm serious.
Yeah, I know.
You know,
it's better than...
There's a scientist I saw once on a documentary years ago talking about in Hollywood's depiction of alien beings. And he was a biologist and saying, you know what movie was the most accurate for me when it comes to aliens? The Blob. Does anybody remember that classic B horror movie, The Blob? But that thing was completely amorphous. It just gathered up stuff that was around it and apparently digested it. It had no face, it had no eyes or anything like that, but it definitely had some ability to sense the world around it. That was truly alien. Yeah. Every other alien you see in a movie, it has a face. Mm-hmm. The face
and
is
the body,
unique.
A human body.
Not just human, but
like
just
similar,
something having a face.
Similar
every
to
creature
hands,
has
hands, feet, fingers. Just slightly different form, shape.
Yeah.
But nothing really truly extraterrestrial about it. That's just made because the movies are mainly made for simple minds. So, you know, you have to make things commercial and understandable. Or maybe they don't have imagination. They lack imagination to make a really extraterrestrial being. Like
the
latest movie.
It's the unknown unknown. You can't create that. You can't reckon that by its definition. It is the unknown unknown, as opposed to the known unknown.
Have you seen Prometheus?
I hate quoting that son of a bitch.
Have you seen?
No, I have not.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
It's a new movie production of alien life forms. Okay. So, but what it lacks is really originality. Like, I like how the vehicles are powered by music. You know, the extraterrestrial starts singing at some sort of flute, and that starts some kind of weird luminescent things floating around and starts the space shuttle. But the alien itself, it's still like a humanoid, you know, with two hands, 2 feet, and it's really boring, you know, because even if the being is highly intelligent, wouldn't that mean that he's superior to human morals, like evil, like I want to destroy your world, and
Well, think about it with another example you're more familiar with being, quote, a superior being. When you walk by a dumpster in the city and you see a rat crawl out of it, you don't think the moral implication of the rat's perspective. You don't care. If there's aliens that are that much advanced, it's probably like, you know, maybe there's one of them that's a weirdo like me, and he becomes a somebody who studies insects or something like that, just because he's just interested about them. Well, we're the insects, by analogy.
Precisely.
You know, the idea of invading an anthill doesn't cross any of our minds unless maybe we've had a little bit too much to drink and we've got some dynamite to play with on the 4th of July or something.
Or we want to build a house and we just exterminate it without any comments to the ants.
Yeah, but when you exterminate it, you don't even think about it. You just think, okay, good, now I can start laying out the concrete. You know, you don't think, oh, what must have that have been like for the queen ant down in the thing.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
That's where movies kind of fail, or maybe they just want to create this fantastic story, but it just remains a story and it's really unplausible at all from my perspective.
Or it's just the normal human interaction done with bugs or animals or, you know, like that movie Ants, for example, or any children's thing with talking animals. I mean, the animals aren't acting like animals. If they were, they wouldn't be talking, obviously. It'd be like watching a nature documentary. You know?
Yeah. Also, you know, with the thing with people creating all these little subcultures where they say they actually believe in the movies and they create religions based off of movies like Jedi religion and all sorts of crap, basically, or they inspire from the designs of the movie to actually tell their own stories about the aliens that they've seen. You know, they they draw this species that it's exactly the same like E.T., you know, nothing really original. And they expect other people to believe, and they believe it. And they sort of enter their little congregations. And this just amazes me how ignorant people really are and easy to manipulate with useless bullshit.
Yeah, the 80s had a theme of movies with children overriding the state for some reason. I don't know if anybody remembers the movie War Games, where the kids end up taking over the ICBM system because they ended up cracking a code because they didn't have a password. An oddly believable situation, actually. But yeah, it was a theme of 80s movies. And yeah, you always have whatever the you know, the whatever the hoi poi are thinking at the time, colloquially being superimposed upon any idea, be it aliens, ancient history, interpretations of the past, or anything else. I mean, you know, like when you explain how animals are living and stuff like that, you know, people think, you know, oh, these deer keep running in front of the cars. These deer are really stupid, blah, blah, blah. Well, the thing you don't understand is the way their eyes work. The headlights blind them. They can't see because they have a kind of night vision. So it's not that the animal's stupid. It's just the, there's so many things that come from ignorance.
It's just like that stunning. That little butterfly, you know, with the night butterfly who goes to the light, follows the light.
You're talking about a moth.
Yeah, and then he dies and just stays on the computer screen until someone destroys him.
Yeah. You know? There's a culture somewhere that I read once, I can't remember where or when, but they believe the moths were the souls of the damned, and the reason they behave the way they do is they're damned to, you know, all their existence involves is essentially reproducing and killing themselves. And the way moths are stupid. I mean, I'm sorry, but I just said how this was not something you should be applying to animals because of the interpretation of the perspectives, but they definitely behave in a whimsical way that lends one to think they're quite stupid. And indeed suicidal. They'll just fly into a flame.
Yeah, like humans do. Sometimes we don't judge what our acts will do for our future, and we then just die. And maybe some superior beings just look at this as some sort of primitive mechanism of self-destructiveness. If you know, Eric Fromm made a study on the self-destructiveness of the human society. It's called A Sane Society. But in fact, the title is ironical because it's an insane society, you know.
Yeah.
So I suggest people should research that book. Yeah,
I've heard of it, but I haven't read it. But I see where you're going with it.
Yeah, it's we're a race of self-destructive idiots.
Well, it's been a weird whatever has happened in human history in human past it's been an odd ride, at least as far as we could tell, and no other animal's done anything anywhere close to this, and I don't think anybody planned it. I don't think there's, you know, it's just happening. Like a river flows and it encounters harder and softer rocks and erodes them. Nobody planned where the river was going to go. It just goes because it's following natural processes. Exactly. What's going to happen to us is going to be extinction. By definition, everything goes extinct at some point, and other life forms start coming up. That's just what we see in the fossil record. That's apparently the way it works. What'll happen to us is we'll either end up destroying ourselves or evolving into something different. but humanity, such as it is not going to continue forever. Nothing does.
Do you think it will be possible to evolve in more cybernetic humans sort of beings?
Unfortunately, yes. Yeah.
Why do you say unfortunately?
Like, I don't think it's a good idea. Mm-hmm. But
Reason
I don't think it's a good idea is because I think what could easily happen is the machine will be so superior to man that man will die out, and then you'll just have machines, and you won't have a symbiosis. You'll just have machines. In order to have a symbiosis, there'd have to be some sort of reason to still keep the biological body. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if, I mean, it depends on how they make the robots. Like, a friend of mine always jokes, you know, in the future, the only jobs are going to be repairing the robots that do all the other jobs. And I say, well, that's only if you design the robots so that only humans can repair them instead of so that other robots could repair them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, you can get it to a point where we are completely pointless.
And, humans are obsolete.
Exactly.
But
the way into consciousness, can you transfer human consciousness into a non-biological medium? That's a totally different question right there, because at that point, would humanity continue to exist because you'd have human consciousness living inside of what's basically an electronic machine?
Well, in terms of space, there exists a way to surpass the human, what the human brain is capable of keeping, but in terms of the way our brain works, no, we would need incomprehensible calculating machinery that we do not have yet. Even at a nanotechnological scale, it's really hard to create. So I don't know who wired our brains or how it evolved, but it's superior to the machines in terms of its abstractness. It's not good for calculating, but it's good for experiencing life, and that's it. That's about it.
But that's the same thing people said 200 years ago before they had steam engines. Why am I going to use your weird doohickey when my horse and mule have worked just fine for thousands of years?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody even thinks about using a horse and a mule these days.
Well, the way I see it, this cybernetic evolution is like the way you go and buy an iPad or something. You know, it will start as a consumer thing. You know, get this...
Well, probably start as a military thing for war. That's how computers pretty much, at least in modern computers. I don't know if anybody's heard of the Antikythera, alternately pronounced the Antikythera mechanism. You look up Derek de Sola Price, Gears from the Greeks, a calendar computer from circa 70 BC. That thing could make calculations of equinox, it could tell you equinoxes. It was a calendar computer. You could program a date into that computer, and it would tell you where the constellations would be, whether or not the moon, what phase the moon would be in, and whether or not there would be a lunar or a solar eclipse. And it's made out of a complex gearing that is from a shipwreck from 70 BC.
Whoa.
That I consider the first computer in the West. There's an ancient or more ancient computer from China that I don't know enough about to even really discuss. I could just tell you that basically the Chinese beat us to everything. that's a safe assumption in history.
Yeah, that's probably because they are smaller and faster. You know, so maybe their time perception is little different.
Well, one thing is they didn't really have to deal with anybody in terms of getting invaded from other things and stuff like that. They had a certain amount of isolation going on where it was sort of like one cult. I mean, I'm not saying they didn't have wars, obviously, but they were fighting each other as opposed to, you know, in Egypt, they're dealing with invasions from Persia and Rome.
Yeah. You know? Budget cuts for research.
Yeah, that's a modern retrojection.
I know that in India, mathematics was very evolved in the astronomy. Everything was, if you search the planet names and all of the star names are like Indian culture type names because they were discovered and named by these Indian researchers until it all moved to Europe and now it's in the U.S.
Yeah.
And now our planets have the name of MX-64 and stuff like that.
Indian numerals always crack me up because if you ask an Indian, the numeral started in India and went to Arabia. And if you ask somebody from Arabia, they say the numeral started in Arabia and went to India. But I side with the Indians on that one, just because of the fact that the civilization and prosperity is more ancient on that side as opposed to the West. Mm-hmm. So I think they're right, but that they did invent what we now think of in the West as Arabic numerals, even though our Arabic numerals are look a little different than the actual Arabic numerals. If you want to look those up, you can Google it. There's like 8 different ways to make a 5. Some of them look like 7s. It's anyway. But
they're talking about diversity.
Yeah.
And the Chinese language is very interesting as well. Like a little sign in the symbol in the middle of the phrase can modify the whole meaning for the whole sentence.
Well, you have to be careful not to confuse the written language with the spoken language.
Oh, I mean about the written
language. Spoken language always comes first, unless we're talking about a modern made-up language that linguists like to come up with, like a Desperado, for example. But Chinese is and there's different Chinese languages. They're not just dialects. They are, I think, their own different languages. They're from the same language family, but they have tones. And these little dots, I'm just making a leap in the dark here right now, but I have a friend of mine who does know Chinese. I can ask him about this. They're probably signaling tones. You could say ha, 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 and those are 3 different words that mean dirt, gun, sun. You know, totally different things. That's why you have the old joke of some business guy going to China and he tries to say, oh, hello, nice to meet you. And he says, hi, Mr. Poo Poo Face. You know. That's how you get that. Because you have a language where the difference is signaled with tones. You can have an inflected or an inflexive language like Latin or Romanian or any language in Europe, really, other than English, where you have different endings and prefixes and suffixes that are added to the word to signal grammatical change and stuff like that, past tense, future tense, possessive, you know, all that stuff. You could do the same thing with tones. You could also use clicks, like the Khoisan languages in Africa. Now, there's some of those languages that have up to 4 different clicks, 4 distinct click sounds.
I just know 3 of them.
Like, oh, okay. What are they?
Like there is this one, you know. Then there is a, you know.
All right.
And then there is this one, you know. So I know 3.
Well, you're better than me because they all basically sound the same. But I have a hearing problem. I can't tell the difference between a D and a T.
Like there are clicks that you can do with your teeth and your tongue, and then you sort of put your tongue before the teeth, and you make the second click. And I just learned this from YouTube. There was a guy who actually. You know, I wanted to learn about the clicking languages, and he did a tutorial on them because he was from an African country that uses clicks.
Right. Right. Well, that's very interesting. Some people speculate in linguistics that the clicks, because the thing when you have the history of language, let's say you have somebody that, like with English, when the Normans invaded, they would pronounce the words that they were learning, you know, because they just invaded all these foreigners. They're not going to learn the language completely. The complicated stuff they drop, and later on, that ends up sticking and becomes kind of like a new language. Well, if you have these clicks in a language and somebody invades them and speaks something else and they don't do the clicks, those clicks are going to be the first things to go. So for them to preserve implies a kind of antiquity. It's a guess, frankly, in linguistics, but people think that some of the first languages probably had click sounds. So,
yeah, there are, but I think isolation is the key towards preserving such languages, you know?
Oh, you know where the other example of a click language outside of Africa is? I'm not making this up. There's a certain group of Aborigines in Australia, and there's a separate little sub-language in that language that's spoken only amongst mothers and mothers-in-law, you know, between the daughters-in-law and the mothers-in-law.
Yes.
And that language has a click.
Interesting.
That's it. That's it. That's the only other one that's extant that we know about. Now, 50,000 years ago, these could have been running all over the place, for all we know. There probably were some in the New World. 90% of the population was killed before any Europeans even saw the people. So the, you know, think about all that there could have been that we are never going to know about. The diseases spread with the trade routes so that the population was decimated. The population was decimated before Europeans even got the north and south, the interior and south, the north and south, North America and South America. There would have been vast, there would have been vast, you know, the culture, the linguistics, the linguistics splint is incredible. The only other place that rivals it, or actually has the most linguistic diversity, is the island of Papua New Guinea. I think it's something like 30% of languages in the world are spoken on that island.
30%?
Yeah, as a number. Like, there's about 6,000 languages being spoken. 20 of them are spoken by, like, 95% of the world population. And then the other 5% are these other little teeny little obscure, mostly indigenous primal cultures. And, like I say, yeah, about 30% of those are spoken on the island of Papua New Guinea. They've also had agriculture on that island since 30,000 years ago, which is another thing that upsets the paradigm. Yeah,
with what we were talking in the first part of the show.
Yeah. The problem is that it's an incomplete agriculture. They don't have protein. They don't have animals. All they have is taro, breadroot, and this other tree that they can eat. But they augment their protein with they actually would eat spiders a lot and other insects, and they would hunt I think there were some monkeys and a few other mammals and stuff like that and birds, but it was very difficult for them to get protein apparently, but it was enough to survive.
Yeah. So, if you have all agriculture, basically you have the keys to become an empire.
Well, they never spread. I mean, the interior of New Guinea wasn't even explored until aircraft were invented. Nobody bothered to go up into those mountains. Those people, there were people, Jared Diamond, who did Guns, Germs, and Steel. He also wrote a book called Collapse of Civilization. He went out there studying birds in the 1970s, and he was finding tribes that got steel axes 3 years before he was there, and that was in the late 70s. They hadn't even seen any modern people at all, and then that's as recently as the 70s.
Well, in the 70s, they just got up there with the cameras, and they saw the people with the cameras, and they thought that they were aliens, so they didn't attack them. They accepted them into their culture.
There was apparently a story with ExxonMobil setting up something on part of that island, and they ended up, I think they built a road that cut off the animal paths that they were hunting or something, so they ended up basically systematically killing every white guy that they found on the island that worked for Exxon, and Exxon had to pull out, and a number of years passed, and
nice.
They came, they ended up coming back, and they're paying royalties essentially to these native groups. It was one of the few success stories of
native groups.
Like yeah,
not getting exterminated for profit.
Right, but it's just because the terrain was so remote and so rugged, and they knew it so well. You know, they have their blowguns and everything, and they're just, you know, picking these guys out, and they can't even see them in the jungle.
That's nice. That's nice. That's really ownage. Like, in this game and the gaming world, it's called Assassin's Creed 3, and you basically play a character that is very evolved, like from the native Indian side. And they are very evolved in climbing trees and stuff. And when the colonists came, they weren't so good with climbing trees and stuff. So they basically killed the colonists from the trees in a very stealthy way.
You're going to hear a funny story about that. People might have heard of Squanto. I'm speaking mostly to my American audience right now. But the story of Squanto, when he came over with the Plymouth settlement and they were all starving that first winter, this Indian actually showed up at their site when everything looked like they weren't going to survive the winter. And this guy shows up, a native Amerindian speaking perfect English, and says, "Hi, how about a beer?" He'd been kidnapped by Englishmen about 15 years previous, enslaved, brought over to England, made to become a Christian and speak the English language, apparently acquired a taste for English ale, went back home and was dumped off. When he got home, the diseases had killed off his whole tribe, so he was wandering around New England, or what's now called New England, in the northeastern United States coast, and he heard that there were some Englishmen that had apparently come over and started, you know, a little settlement or something, and he thought, oh, great, maybe they'll have some beer.
That's nice. A nice one. You know what I find interesting? Mainstream culture is beginning to accept these ideas that in our history, we had dark days, like, for example, in, you know, the fact that Americans are not really true owners of that land, and that they exterminated the Indians very badly before they became the owners. And they actually make games now about that, and you actually play the Indian character, you know, and kill the Americans. So imagine that that's happening in the mainstream culture. I think before that, like in the 50s, 60s, do you remember those Western movies where the Indians were just like, and that's it? You know, right. No knowledge, no ancient history, no nothing special, just some primitive Indians yelling at horses.
You have the opposite of that, too, where you have people that think that the Indians never had warfare and that it was all peace and love and that they got along completely with nature, which, of course, they did, but that doesn't necessarily mean they got along with other tribes. Mm-hmm. And these different tribes are not, you know, it's not like all of North America was one tribe or different tribes of the same culture speaking the same language. No, you have people in 5 miles, 20 miles away from each other that speak languages as different as English is from Chinese. You have different language families, you know, 30 or 40 of them in North America alone that each had hundreds of different languages, none of them mutually intelligible. So, I mean, you've got some people that think, like the Cheyenne, for example, they usually had sex about once or twice a lifetime. That sounds crazy, but the reason they thought of it is that when you have a child, you have one. they suck energy from the mother and the father to become strong. If you have two children, each child's only getting half the energy that they'd otherwise get, so you're having two weak kids instead of one strong kid. No birth control. The only way to make that happen is to practice abstinence. So they have this culture of these games that pit the men against the women, designed specifically to get out the aggression that comes from never being able to poke your wife. You know, they'd leave babies out when they were crying so that the babies would learn if you cry and make a fuss, all people will just abandon you. And they did that because they were usually the underdogs and they had to keep the kids quiet and stuff like that in order to keep from getting killed by the other guys.
Yeah, I guess it's a system that works.
Yeah. You got people out like the Oot out in the Great Basin. There's so few people in the Great Basin in the United States that they actually thought it was insane to kill another human being. The concept of warfare, the concept of killing another human was insane to them because there were so few people out there. When you finally saw somebody, you're like, oh, thank God there's a person. Hey, how you doing, man? Oh, you don't speak my language? That's okay. Hi, you know, I'm so happy I'm around another human being. You know, we're in the middle of fucking nowhere here. Have you ever been to Utah? Yeah.
Yeah.
So a lot of cultures, you know, it's kind of like a child. Some of it is nurture, some of it is nature. When you have a culture, some of it is the environment, some of it is the culture that was just, you know, kind of like natural of humans to have, you know. That's a good example of that.
Cool. So, it's, you know, what I said before with the mainstream culture, it's interesting how, like, in the 50s we were so against them, and now we're all for them, you know. The mainstream culture is not going by the government anymore, you know.
It's a pendulum swing, and right now we're on the other extreme of that pendulum swing.
Mm-hmm. When we will be at the center, though, was there ever a center point?
Well, not if I guess the pendulum's kind of going around.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting.
I think it's a pendulum without the center. It just teleports to the other side. That's it. Teleportation pendulum.
You mind if I take a break for a second, man? We're almost done, but you want to give me like 2 or 3 minutes here?
Yeah, sure. We can stop for about 10 minutes if you want. 5 minutes? I don't know.
Yeah, five minutes.
Cool.
All right. I will be back.
All right. So we're back at Dark City Radio with Miles Crisp and Vostok the Count. We are talking about different things here today, from ancient history to the present, back and forth, languages, mathematics, astronomy, archaeology, everything.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to say in addition to the bit about what I mentioned with Squanto asking for the beer, I got that from professor at Northern Virginia Community College, James McClellan, PhD, who was he's now the Dean of Humanities at Alexandria campus. Anyway, another thing I wanted to get out is everybody says the beginning of America was at Plymouth Rock. It wasn't. That was in 1620. The first one is in Virginia at Jamestown in 1607. I know a lot of people died there for the first 5 years, but it's still the first permanent English-speaking colony in the New World. So, when I said that Squanto was kidnapped previous to the Plymouth Rock, Plymouth Colony, that was possible because the English were there since 1607. You know, at least in that along that coast, and you have to go north following the Gulf Stream in order to go back home to England. So they would have the people coming from Jamestown in 1608, 9, 10, 12, 13, et cetera, would have passed what's now the coast of New England. And they were mapping it, of course, along the way in, you know, various expeditions. So, yeah, also they were, the pilgrims were aiming further south at the time, but they got off track. St. Mary's, Maryland is, I think, the next oldest, but I'm not sure if St. Mary's, Maryland comes after Plymouth Rock or not. Let me check real quick. No, I think Plymouth Rock's older than St. Mary's. But anyway, and the other thing I was going to mention was, great, now I've forgotten. Yeah, I need to write things down.
You need to drink some more beer, my friend.
Maybe that's what the problem is. I just need to type better so that I could look this up. I'd like to have had this looked up beforehand so that I wouldn't have to do this live on the air, because this is annoying. All right, St. Mary's, Maryland was founded in 1632. Okay, that's 12 years after Plymouth. Yeah, I was right. Anyway, so, yeah, it took a long time for the coast to be sub-peopled as well. I mean, it wasn't until the mid-1700s when people were moving beyond the eastern mountains along the east coast of the 13 colonies. That needs to be remembered. You had Charlottesville was frontier with Meriwether Lewis's mother in the 1730s. She actually fended off a 1750s. She actually fended off a brigade of English soldiers during the Revolution. This 90-pound woman holding a big blunderbust apparently made a captain in the army stand down when they were going to ransack her property because the woman was just being a complete C. Another little story there. Oh, I also wanted to talk about some Cherokee mythology before I go. That was the other thing I was going to bring up. The story of the tortoise and the hare is one. The Western white people version of the story in America is that slow and steady wins the race. The tortoise beat the hare. But the Cherokee myth is actually that the tortoise challenged the hare to a race over four mountain ridges, starting on the top of one. So you had whoever gets to the, third ridge down wins. Well, the tortoise got three of his cousins to wait just below the top of each of these ridges before the race began, and the hare couldn't tell a turtle from another tortoise or whatever. I know I'm using that word interchangeably, I shouldn't. But yeah, so that it was actually a trickery that won out, and that's actually the moral of the story. You can probably understand why they changed it for the American audience. You can go in on that. There's another one.
Magical turtles,
Well, they're all anthropomorphized. They all have, talking animals and, things like that. There's another story where the bear apparently cut off their claws so that they could use bow and arrows. And apparently they invented the bow and arrow, but later on, when their bows broke, they couldn't defend themselves, or hunt or anything like that, because they didn't have their claws. So they decided that they should give that up. Man took that and started abusing the ability to hunt with this tool given to them by the animals. It's a theme in the mythology. Everything's given to them by the animals. So the animals got together and created diseases. And the diseases were actually, in biology, the diseases do usually come from animals, but that's a different story. So the animals got pissed at the people over hunting and hunting for sport and stuff like that, so they created diseases. The plants took pity on us, and the plants decided to create remedies and cures for the illnesses that the animals were using to get back at humanity. And again, that was a parallel in science, because a lot of cures and remedies do indeed come from plants. So I think that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's also interesting how humanity in general has
underestimated its powers of creating things and always attributed those things to some kind of external power, like in the old mythologies, animals, and later on God, and now aliens, just like we were talking before.
Yeah, and again, these are things that people are familiar with at the time. You know, the Cherokee Indians would have been familiar with these animals we're talking about.
And plants.
And right now we're familiar with machines and technology and Star Wars. And you're saying Star Wars is a religion earlier. Well, it's the other way around. Star Wars is just a bunch of archetypal things taken from religions and put into a modern parallel. Mm-hmm. It's not supposed to be something you worship. It's supposed to be a nice story.
People
no more
started
or less.
To worship it and created a congregation in Australia.
Anybody that's listening, I would recommend seeing the movie Man from Earth. It's about a 30,000-year-old caveman who just never ages.
Genius movie.
Yeah. The thing I like about that is that could be a play done in high schools. There's three scenes in the whole movie. You can make a play out of that, man. I mean, that's basically a play. It's all just taking place in a living room, in a kitchen, and just outside of it. But, that was one of the things the guy said is, you know, they took this, great idea and then, you know, warped it and built a belief system out of it.
Yeah, I remember. I remember it.
Yeah.
There were also some other interesting things, like the only boring thing in his existence was that man always repeated the same mistakes throughout history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also like the thing, when he was carrying out the boxes and he picks up a pen and he says, "Are you going to have this pen 500 years from now? Why would you keep it? Why would you have thought to have kept it? No, I don't have any proof." You know?
Yeah, it will be useless. There's no way to, you know.
The guy was asking,
"Give me some evidence from 20,000 years ago."
Right.
Stupid. Yes.
So.
And at the end, "I am your father." Yeah, whatever. We shouldn't spoil it for people. It's not the end.
It was written by Jerome Bixby, and he was. He also wrote a few Twilight Zone episodes. He wrote a few Star Trek Next Generation episodes. And I think he was also a writer with Stargate, the movie, not the TV. Or actually, may have been the TV show. By the way, I don't like the TV show. I love the movie. There, I said it.
Yes, me too. I believe Star Trek or Stargate.
I was talking about Stargate. The Stargate TV show is shit. Yeah. The movie was brilliant. There's no sequel to it. It doesn't need to have a sequel to it. They blew the bad guy up at the end. Come on. It's done. It's just a movie. It's a good movie. Don't make sequels.
Maybe. Yeah, but people want to see the same characters having a new adventure. You know, just like...
Well, then buy a few of those books that you see in the movie when Daniel's getting those, you know, the one that has the ancient river goddess, the ancient Nile river goddess on it with the arms going up. That book is, I haven't read it and I can't remember the name of it, but some of the things that he was referencing in that lecture, the movie came out in either 93 or 94, and the documentary hosted by Charlton Heston with Robert Schock and John Anthony West on the redating of the Sphinx was from 93. And the conference was in 1991 or 92, the Geological Association conference that Schock attended when the geologic community accepted his evidence. He was directly referring to that in the first bit of that movie. That's one of the main reasons why I really like it, because when I was a kid, I saw that when I was like 8 years old, and then I saw that movie, and I was like, oh, wow, I just made a connection of something. I was very proud of myself at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I was in like second grade, didn't know how to read.
Do you think there are any legit, actual history-based movies created by men? I don't know.
For example,
short answer is no. I mean, there's bits and pieces from a few I could point out, but no, not really, because it would just be too boring if they did it. There's a movie that has Dustin Hoffman when he was young in the 70s called Little Big Man. It's not historically accurate, but it is culturally accurate. As my friend's dad says, oh yeah, that Western movie with the gay Indian, as he remembers it. But no, they actually had a half man, half woman. You know, that was perfectly acceptable in their culture. If you wanted to be a little sissy guy and hang out with the women and cook and clean and take care of the kids, fine, go for it. I don't want you next to be on the battlefield. Yeah, you know what I mean? If you don't want to go fight, don't fight. You know, they weren't stupid about that. And they also didn't, and this is a theme with some, but not all, native groups, is they didn't beat their children into submission. When they got rowdy, they harnessed that. You know? Oh, you wanna start acting up right now and not doing what I say? How about you go fuck up with the other tribe, and if you come back alive next Tuesday, you're probably not gonna have the same attitude. You know?
Yeah, man.
So,
right. So we're getting close to the near the end here. Is there anything like you want to say, in like an epic ending to this awesome show you did?
Well, I would like to apologize for my lack of planning. I meant to spend at least yesterday, you know, coming up with, you know, a lot of notes and at least practicing and stuff like that. I've never been on a radio show like this before. I've called in to Douglas Dietrich's show, which I would recommend anybody listen to him. He's been on Coast. He's been on James Arthur Yancic's show. Very, very solid source if you like alternative history stuff. He's into the history. I'm into the stuff before that. Otherwise, all I can really say is, thank you for the opportunity. I hope people are still awake if they stayed tuned. Let me know how boring I am. Let me know what I'm doing right, what I'm doing wrong. I'm happy to change. Give me some feedback. That's about it.
Cool. Okay. This has been the, what's the title of your show? The Divergent
History.
Divergent History Show.